You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 28th of April 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I am Markus Hippi. On today's show, as the extent of the destruction to the city of Aleppo becomes clear, we'll ask whether the international community's gaze is returning to Syria's civil war. The political correspondent Darren McCaffrey and the commentator Oscar Guardiola Rivera will be with me to discuss that and more of the day's news. Also ahead, following a major sale of Modern Masters in Shanghai that failed to meet estimates, we'll ask whether the major international auction houses are getting it wrong on mainland China.
China will always be a market for Chinese auction houses. They're doing quite well, but the way they do things is very particular to the market.
And before the end of the program, we'll check in with one of our correspondents around the world and review the arts in Turkey. Today we'll hear about the so-called Disobedience Archive that chronicles protests in Istanbul and beyond.
It looks at the kind of relationship between artistic practice and political action, and it's raising this kind of heightened attention to what exactly the relationship is between art and political action.
That and more to come on Midori House with me, Markus Hippi. So lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House, but before all that, here is Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news.
Germany has urged Moscow today to use its influence on pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine to secure the release of seven observers, which include four Germans, from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, who are currently being held in the city of Slovyansk. The plea comes as the United States imposed new sanctions on seven Russian government officials and 17 companies over the Ukraine crisis. The Russians include Igor Sechin, head of Russia's major oil company Rosneft, and a close ally of President Vladimir Putin. Well, the US President Barack Obama mentioned the sanctions at a banquet dinner held in his honor on a state visit to the Philippines.
There's a path here to resolve this, but Russia has not yet chosen to move forward, and these sanctions represent the next stage in a calibrated effort to change Russia's behavior. We don't yet know whether it's going to work, and that's why the next phase, if in fact we saw further Russian aggression towards Ukraine, could be sectoral sanctions, less narrowly targeted, addressing sectors like banking or the defense industries.
An Egyptian court has sentenced the leader of the outlawed Muslim Brotherhood and 682 supporters to death today. Meanwhile, the Qatar-based satellite network Al Jazeera has served Egypt with a $150 million compensation claim for what it said was damage to its media business inflicted by Cairo's military rulers, a step likely to worsen Qatari-Egyptian relations. The United States and the Philippines sealed a new 10-year security pact today. The agreement is expected to pave the way for a larger U.S. military presence in the island nation. It was signed by the U.S. ambassador to the Philippines, Philip Goldberg, and the Philippine Defense Secretary, Voltar Gazmin.
This agreement allows us to work on what is called for under the MDT, which is the development of individual and collective capacities and sustain our ability to undertake what is possible under the VFA, which are training and exercises.
Algeria's President Abdelaziz Bouteflika has been sworn in for a fourth five-year term on Monday after he easily won an election opponents dismissed as fraudulent, returning the ailing 77-year-old to power. A fragile-looking Bouteflika sat in a wheelchair to take the oath and give a brief statement in one of his rare public appearances since a stroke last year that raised questions about his ability to govern. In California, Los Angeles Clippers players made a silent protest during pre-game warm-ups when they exposed T-shirts that were turned inside out to hide any reference to the team. The protest was against racist comments allegedly made by the team's owner, Donald Sterling. He's facing intense criticism after a celebrity news site posted a 10-minute recording in which a person reported to be him tells a woman not to post photographs of herself with black people online and not to bring African Americans to Clippers games. Doc Rivers, the head coach of the Clippers, preferred to concentrate on the game.
Could have. I'm not going to deny that we had other stuff I just believe when the game starts, and nobody cares anymore. Golden State surely didn't care. And it's just like when a player plays with an injury. They don't care that you're injured. They're going to come out and they're going to try to attack you. So if we were injured physically or mentally, the other team doesn't care, and they really shouldn't care.
And finally, staying in California, a cooling off period has been called in the fight between the makers of a hot chili sauce and a city that says its air is too spicy to bear. The Irwindale City Council says Hoi Fong Foods will have 90 days to stop releasing the spicy emanations from its factory that neighbors say are burning their eyes and throats. But the mayor of Irwindale, Mark Braceda, did admit that he likes the chili sauce. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
And those were the latest news headlines from Jonathan Wheatley. Thank you very much. Jonathan, we'll be back with even more in 24 minutes. Meanwhile, you are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We are back right after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monaco 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monaco 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
And you are listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.07 and it is 13.07 in New York. Joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Darren McCaffrey, a political reporter with Sky News here in London, and Oscar Guardiola-Rivera from London's Birkbeck College. Welcome both to the programme.
Good evening.
It has been 3 years since protesters took to the streets in cities across Syria, an act of public disobedience which has become one of the most brutal civil wars of the 21st century. A team of BBC journalists has recently gained access to the northern city of Aleppo, Syria's former commercial hub and one of the flashpoints of the war. And the devastation the reporters have witnessed was massive. So-called barrel bombs are being used increasingly, it seems, against rebel forces who still hold around half of the city. Darren, if I start with you, it seems now that the international community has turned its gaze away from the conflict in Syria. Do you think reports like this can actually help galvanize the political will to try and draw the war to a close?
I think they will in the sense. I mean, that's what journalism's meant to be. And you're right, with what's happened in the Ukraine, with that missing plane, Syria really has fallen off to a large degree, the kind of international media sphere. And this is the first attempt, I think, by the BBC to get into Aleppo this year. This is a city where 70% of the population have already left. The city is massively in ruins. And yet the regime seems to be stepping up again its campaign. The use of these barrel bombs chucked out of helicopters, pretty crude devices, got explosives and lots of metal in them. Completely random destructiveness, undoubtedly leading to hundreds of casualties every time they're used, and indiscriminate. I suppose by Western media again putting the spotlight on this conflict is a reminder that it really hasn't gone away. A third of the people in Syria are still displaced, and day in, day out, attacks are still taking place, attacks on both sides. And you listen to the stories coming from this city of the few people who remain there, but remain there saying they live in danger, they live in fear, they live frightened every day. And they've got to the point now, this is obviously was a rebel stronghold, but they've got to the point now where they are so war weary of this happening day after day that they just want to see an end to it. And that may precisely be the strategy of al-Assad, that he has just ground down not only the rebel forces, but also the sympathetic people there, because they just don't want this anymore.
Anyway, we can't deny that we would not have known what is going on in Syria and Aleppo, that there's been so much destruction and so on. Oscar, what is your view? Do you think this can actually lead into something, this kind of reporting from there, where we actually see with our own eyes what the situation is over there?
The reporting you tell us about ended with the testimony of a Syrian civilian who pointed out that although it all began with a call to democracy and human rights and so on and so forth, all they care about right now is for an end to this conflict, which means that actually both the reporting and the conflict has changed. It is no longer as black and white as we would like it to be. It is quite complicated. This story comes in the wake of the revelations made by Seymour Hersh concerning the possibility that sarin may have been used by the opposition forces, and a counterclaim published recently in the newspapers, which makes this conflict all the more dogged. It's becoming increasingly difficult to distinguish these from that. And if you add to that the fact that those with the power to at least try and contain it, that is to say, the West and Russia, are now in a bit of a squabble themselves, this is just incredibly bad news for Syrian civilians and for the rest of us.
Well, we have to remember as well about how this conflict, as Oscar rightly points out, has changed. This time last year, we were talking about giving aid and help to the rebels. There was an argument in Britain and other Western countries about potentially supplying weapons. In September, we were talking about potential airstrikes. Now we've got Tony Blair, the Middle East envoy, one of the biggest backers of intervention, saying that, well, it's too late. Al-Assad may well have to remain as an interim leader. We've got to the stage where Al-Assad is now organising presidential elections, where he will probably undoubtedly win, in a country where elections, least of all democratic elections, would seem nigh impossible. And it seems doggedly that if you hold on and persist with violence, without really any Western intervention, you succeed, you stay. And that's what Al-Assad wanted, and it seems that's what he's got.
Do you think the situation can remain like this indefinitely?
Well, it will remain like this for the time being. Again, this is not a matter that could be solved solely by means of Western intervention. Let us not forget that Middle Eastern powers, mainly Saudi Arabia and the Emirate of Qatar, are immured in the war that they are now defending interests of their own, which do not necessarily resonate with Western interests. On the other hand, there is once more the conflict with Russia, which makes it nigh impossible to find the kind of all-sided support for a Security Council resolution, the kind of which we saw not too long ago, precisely because of the inhumanity and severity of the attacks on civilians which have been reported.
And one of the aspects we regularly follow when it comes to Syria is obviously Syria's agreement to move its chemical weapons arsenals abroad. Do you think this is actually going to happen as planned?
Well, we've got to the point now where apparently 92% of the chemical weapons have been put beyond use. They've missed a deadline of today for the remainder of the 8%, though it is expected that nuclear weapons as a factor will be completely gone by the end of June, which is what the international community wanted. However, there is suggestions that the government forces still may be using them and where they're getting access to this. But I think if you look at the key players involved in all of this, you're right, you've got Russia. The West is far more concerned and interested now with Ukraine and that conflict involving Russia. Iran is another big player in all of this. And again, the West is involved in quite complex negotiations with Iran about its nuclear weapons program. And so Syria really is it's not important right now to the main international players. And I think what is going to happen with this conflict is that Al-Assad will stay in power. He will undoubtedly probably win this election. The country will remain in a state a bit like Chechnya, where you will have guerrilla warfare every so often, but Assad will be able to hold it down through sheer brutality, like the use of these barrel bombs.
Darren and Oscar, let's move pretty much to the other side of the planet then. Let's move to Brazil. Paulo Malgaj was a colonel in the Brazilian army during the military dictatorship which ruled Brazil between 1964 and 85. And last month, this colonel appeared before the country's National Truth Commission, which was formed 3 years ago to examine crimes committed by the country's former military rulers. And he admitted to having tortured and killed political prisoners. And he also told the commission that he did not regret these crimes. Well, on Saturday, a group of men broke into Colonel Malgai's home on the outskirts of Rio de Janeiro and smothered him with a pillow. Oscar, if I start with you, how much do we know about any possible connections between Malgai's death and his confession to the National Truth Commission?
Well, not much so far, although the media and also testimonials and shadow reporting do suggest that there is a connection. What isn't clear is whether the connection has to do with the fact that he went to the Truth Commission and made these revelations, or else the fact that although he made these revelations, he seemed to remain unrepentant about what he had done those many years ago. But in any case, what this story reveals is the failure of forms of transitional justice that reduce these necessary cases of social togetherness to forgive and forget. The very idea that in Brazil what has happened is a sort of compromise with the military, not to touch the military, to turn the page and move on. That is still a very controversial issue. The fact of human rights violations during the dictatorship remains very much alive, and it is part and parcel of what people who were protesting in the streets and will protest again are calling for. The fact that the injustices of the past do weigh on the present.
In a way, this case is an example of how wounds run deep. Forget and forgive. It's not an easy task, is it?
Not only is it not an easy task, it might be the case that it is the wrong strategy. Part of what happens in Brazil is that Brazil has not confronted head-on its immediate past. The so-called transition to democracy was built upon a very fragile compromise, which included a sort of forgetfulness on the side of what the military had done. So we haven't had the kinds of cases that we have seen in Argentina, for instance, when the amnesty laws were brought down and high-level military men were put on trial and went to jail. We have seen nothing of the sort in Brazil, and that's that may be the root of the problem.
Darren, how do you see this? National Truth Commissions are often perceived as positive moves for a country that has gone through dark periods in its recent past. Do they always work?
Well, do they always work? I mean, South Africa is obviously the shining example that people point to, where they think that the kind of Truth and Reconciliation Commissions that we saw post-apartheid did bring some justice. I mean, I must say, I'm from Northern Ireland, and we've had a pretty troubled 30 years or so, and there's been a lot of talk about whether, again, there, something replicating what happened in South Africa would help. And it is very, very difficult, because by opening up and revisiting the past, you open up and you damage wounds. And to outsiders, and particularly people not terribly caught up in a conflict or not the victims of these crimes, it may seem sensible that the only way that you can move on is almost to forgive and forget, because you could end up endlessly pursuing this and wasting the future looking back at the past. But at the same time, that's very easy for someone who hasn't been a victim, who hasn't seen an injustice. And so I think, like all countries, it's going to have to be a balance of the two, in a sense, that the most blatant injustices will have to be dealt with, or else people will not be able to move on with. While at the same time, dwelling too much on it really does take a country's future away. I think it's really interesting in terms of where Brazil finds itself now. This is obviously a country that's going to host the World Cup in 6 weeks' time. It's a country, though, I've been watching reports where the military are now in many of the shanty towns in Rio trying to deal with unrest. It's a country that wants to present itself as a maturing democracy. And yet it's also a country where I think the police shoot dead 7 people every day. So the kind of legacy of what went on in the past is still, I'm sure, found to be in many of the institutions that Brazil find today.
And Oscar, do we even have rules when it comes to the work of this kind of National Truth Commissions? When is the work done?
Well, it isn't done if the current beneficiaries of past injustice are allowed to keep their profits and their benefits. And that's precisely what is at stake in Brazil. part and parcel of the protests that we have seen in the streets and will see again during the World Cup, I'm sure, has to do precisely with the fact that not only the past was not dealt with in terms of human rights violations, but also that the infrastructure and the very economic shape of wealth distribution and power remains tilted in favor of those who benefit from the past.
We're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Marcus Hippi, Darren McCaffrey and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. When we return, we look ahead to the biggest jobs in Europe, which will become vacant in a few months' time. Do stay with us.
On this week's edition of the Foreign Desk, we head to Africa to ask the liberation question.
It was across ethnic lines, across class lines, across religious lines, and they all came together in this broad alliance.
As South Africa prepares to vote in an election that the ANC will win outright, we'll ask why liberation movements that came to power decades ago have rarely been voted out.
You know, I thought that old thing, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts, was just one of those phrases. But I think in the last few years, it's been proved true time and time again.
From Zimbabwe to South Africa, Namibia to Somaliland, we'll assess how liberation movements across Africa have fared so differently as they transitioned from rebels to the holders of power.
In some ways, Somaliland has got the most democratic, fair political system in the whole of East and the Horn of Africa.
That's the liberation question, this week's edition of the Foreign Desk on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It is 2021 in Helsinki, 1821 in London, 1321 in New York City. Still with me is Oscar Guardiola Rivera and Darren McCaffrey. In a few weeks, Europeans head to the polls to vote in this year's European elections, but also up for grabs shortly after Election Day will be some of the European Commission's top jobs, many of which were created last time around. Herman Van Rompuy, the head of the European Council, Catherine Ashton, the EU's Foreign Affairs Representative, and José Manuel Barroso, the President of the European Commission, will all leave their posts later this year. So, who might take over, and how have these new positions impacted the EU's work both at home and abroad? Darren, what's your conclusion?
Who are these people? I mean, you ask any European who Herman Van Rompuy is. I mean, not even the Belgians, where he's a former prime minister, probably know who he is. You've got Catherine Ashton, who's the highest paid female politician in the world. And yet, she's British, and most people in Britain wouldn't know who she was, let alone what she does. And I think there are big questions for the European Union. We've always got European Union elections coming up in a few weeks' time, and they will elect MEPs who have got growing influence in how Europe is run. But many of these positions, for example, Van Rompuy's position as EU Council President, is not actually elected by MEPs. He's elected by members of state. And this comes back down to the kind of key democratic deficit that we have in the European Union, where people just don't feel a connection because they don't vote for these people. I mean, indirectly, yes, the Commission President, Barroso position, is elected. But certainly Cathy Ashton, who is Europe's foreign affairs minister.
I've seen her face in the news quite
many times.
We
have seen her face. And to be fair to Baroness Ashton, I think she has grown into the role. And it is a role, particularly when it comes to Iran, maybe less so with Ukraine recently, that she has proved quite instrumental. But at the same time, I think for Europeans to feel and that they trust in the European Union, they have to know who these people are. They have to know what they do. And I think that some form of kind of direct election would really help.
Oscar, what's your view? How useful have these positions been for us?
Look, let me begin by saying that European politics are far too important to be left in the hands of European politicians, and particularly those who might be elected from the far right in the next election. This is deeply troubling. It is deeply troubling as an observer from another part of the world who admires or used to admire the European model, to see it crumbling under the weight of prejudices, bureaucracy, and what we used to call call a democratic deficit. Now I have to tell my students that this is no longer a democratic deficit, but a democratic failure. This is a total disaster. There is no Europe. People do not feel represented. So it needs a radical reform.
How now, do we fix this?
Well,
then?
Precisely. These new jobs were part of an attempt to actually provoke the kind of democratic sympathy that would be expected. But of course, if these elections and these politicians keep speaking the language of austerity and a two-tiered Europe, which effectively exists by now, the North on the one side and the South on the other, with Europe sort of colonizing itself, which is a very weird phenomenon if you come from Latin America, as I do. Then, of course, what your best bet is to go for, some of the more rebellious names in this list. Alexis Tsipras, for instance. Maybe that's what is required if we want to stop those far righters. Some of them...
What's properly needed is names people recognise. Herman Van Rompuy and Baroness Ashton were appointed these posts precisely because they're dull and no one's heard of them.
Yes.
And they were there really not to do very much. That was the purpose of why they were appointed there. If Tony Blair, for example, who was mooted at the time as being a potential EU Commission president, had have been put in place, or EU Council president, undoubtedly that would have provoked, and he would have been pretty interventionist, and people in Europe would know who he was and what he did.
Darren McCaffrey and Oscar Guardiola Rivera are here with me in the studio. And before we draw the conversation to a close, let's head to Rome.
Et Spiritus Sancti.
The scene in St. Peter's Square yesterday as Pope Francis made two of his predecessors, Pope John XXIII and Pope John Paul II, saints in the presence of huge crowds in Rome and the scenes of mass celebration in Latin America and in Poland. Oscar Guardiola Rivera, what role do saints play outside of the framework of the church today? Can you give us your quick analysis on the wider significance of this?
In a couple of phrases, other than brilliant music and some good paintings, pretty much nil. At least not in the sense of, giving the church a more progressive outlook. Coming from Latin America, the place of the Second Reformation, that liberation theology was, and knowing of the fact that John Paul II and his Cardinal Ratzinger led the excommunion against most liberation theologians, well, his canonization will not be greeted favorably in many quarters in Latin America. But of course, these symbols do help to revamp a certain view of the church as and its saints as
Darren, what's your view?
I've got one name for you, a saint that probably one of the most widely celebrated saints of the world, Saint Patrick. Now, he's not necessarily saint celebrated for his pious being, but more a celebration of drinking. And I almost think that sums up where the outreach of saints goes beyond the church these days. They become kind of symbols of nationhood to a degree rather than anything terribly religious. What I would say is, first of all, saints are meant to be connected to miracles. I think particularly Pope John Paul II's connection to a miracle is pretty slim. And also we have to remember, this is a pope who was in charge at a time of a huge cover-up of child abuse. And I do think the church, which is, to be fair, tried to deal with this under Pope Francis in recent years, it seems to be kind of taking a step back by canonising someone who was in charge while there was wide-scale cover-up. And I think for the thousands of children abused, it really is a slap in the face.
This is the Vatican's way of producing a blank amnesty for such heinous deeds.
Yeah, I find it utterly bizarre. And what's the fastest canonisation in history? I mean, I really think the church, being sensible, would have most certainly held back on this.
We'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much, Darren McCaffrey and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Thank you for visiting us here at Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, 这是 Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
There is plenty more to come on the second half of today's edition of Midori House. We'll be in China to assess the mixed fortunes of some of the world's leading art auction houses there, and we'll review some of the latest cultural offerings in Turkey. But before we get started on all that, here is Jonathan Wheatley with the world news headlines.
Marcus, thanks very much. Germany has urged Moscow today to use its influence on pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine to secure the release of seven observers, which includes four Germans from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, who are currently being held in the city of Slovyansk. The plea comes as the US imposes new sanctions on seven Russian government officials. An Egyptian court has sentenced the leader of the outlawed Muslim Brotherhood and 682 supporters to death today. Meanwhile, the Qatar-based satellite network Al Jazeera has served Egypt with a $150 million compensation claim for what it says was damage to its media business inflicted by Cairo's military rulers, a step likely to worsen Qatari-Egyptian relations. The US and the Philippines have sealed a new 10-year security pact on Monday in Manila. The agreement is expected to pave the way for a larger US military presence in the island nation. And Algeria's President Abdelaziz Bouteflika has been sworn in for a fourth five-year term today after he easily won an election opponents have dismissed as fraudulent, returning the ailing 77-year-old to power. And that's latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much. That was Jonathan Wheatley. And welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. It is time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. And today we head to Brussels, and our correspondent there is Charlotte MacDonald Gibson. Welcome to the program. Shall we start with a slightly lighter story first? There is an auction next week in Brussels of a Soviet capsule that took cosmonauts into space. First of all, what is the story of this capsule, and how on earth has it ended up in Brussels?
Yes, this is a capsule that dates back to the height of the Cold War and the space race in the 1970s. And I'm no space geek, so I'm not exactly sure what it did, but essentially it's some sort of re-entry capsule which held three cosmonauts, or could hold three cosmonauts. I don't know exactly how many cosmonauts it did hold or exactly who was in it, but what we do know is that it circled the Earth twice, once in 1977 and once in 1978. So it certainly has seen space time. And if you're after it, it's a snippet around 1.4 million euros is what it's expected to fetch next week.
How is it being advertised at the moment? What can you do with that kind of a capsule? And do they have any idea who would potentially buy that?
Well, they haven't made any suggestions as to what it could be used for. All they've done is made it quite clear that you can't use it to go into space anymore. I've been looking at, I think, you know, if you're a wealthy family with kids who are into space, you know, they could use it as a little climbing frame, perhaps, or perhaps like a doghouse, and it's kind of that shape. So those are the few ideas that I had, but I think they're more keen on museums or collectors snapping it up and perhaps putting it in pride of place in a museum. But there's one other possibility which I thought of, which is given the nostalgia we're seeing at the moment in Russia for the Soviet Union, if we're looking at some of the rhetoric we're getting out of there with this Ukraine crisis, I was thinking perhaps one of the Russian oligarchs could maybe snap it up as a part of a bit of nostalgia of the old days.
Yeah, who knows? Do you think the timing for this auction is indeed slightly awkward, considering that this capsule basically represents the US-Soviet Cold War space race, and at the same time we are looking at quite icy relations between Russia and the West again?
Yeah, so it's not like the Eurocrats and the diplomats and the ambassadors here in Brussels really needed any more reminders of quite how chilly relations can get between Russia and the US and Europe at the moment, that's for sure. I mean, they're very much aware of it. Just today, they've announced more sanctions on Russia. So, it certainly echoes the past at the moment.
Let's move on to another European Union topic then. Tonight, there is the first ever televised presidential debate between the main candidates to be European Commission president. Do you think anyone is going to be watching that?
Well, I think some people in Brussels might be watching it. I'm not sure for many of my friends back in the UK whether European Union is not hugely popular are going to be glued to their television screens to watch it. It will be interesting to see if they can drum up much excitement in it because they're really desperate to get people to the polls. The elections are now in less than a month. And I haven't seen a huge amount of excitement around Europe for these candidates, for these parties, for the whole idea of the election. So, you know, in a way, it would be great if it could drum up some excitement, but the signs so far haven't been great.
What is your view and conclusion? Is it a mission impossible to make people interested in the upcoming European elections so much so that people would actually go and cast a vote?
Well, it's not impossible because if you look at the extremist parties and the really populist parties, nationalist parties like UKIP in Britain, like the National Front in France, they manage to galvanize their voters. They manage to get them out for these elections. And it's a question of how do they do that? They tap into deep fears. They tap into sort of sentiment that you wouldn't express in mainstream media. So they manage to get voters out. I don't think the European Union, the more mainstream parties, really want to be aping that sort of rhetoric that we see from the further right. So it's a case of, well, let's look at why else some of these extremist parties do well. A lot of them are very charismatic leaders. You've got Marine Le Pen in France, you've got Geert Wilders in the Netherlands. You know, they can build up a crowd. They've got telegenic ways. And the problem is you can't say that about many, you know, real sort of true Brussels Eurocrats. And again, that's a problem with these candidates we've got holding the debate tonight. They're three sort of, you know, three middle-aged men who you'd struggle to pick out of in a lineup. There's one woman, actually. There's a woman from the Green Party, so that's nice to see a woman on the debating panel. But like I said, it's hardly a lineup that's going to set the world alight.
Has there been any other suggestions to do something to try to raise interest, at least?
Not really. I mean, this idea of having these presidential candidates, that is the big new innovation. This is the first European Parliament election that has these candidates where the big political blocs put forward a figurehead. So this really is their big idea, and they're trying to approach it in different ways as well. So one of the candidates is going on a Europe-wide bus tour, so very similar to what the US presidential candidates do. So this is a big innovation this year, so we shall see if it makes a difference.
And then to continue with domestic politics in Belgium, campaigning has finally begun there for the national elections that are going to take place in May. Well, after the previous elections, it took over 540 days for Belgium to actually form a government. Do you think we can expect something similar this time?
Well, that's what everyone is fearing. It was a world record apparently last time, for the longest time without a government, and it's not one that Belgium's particularly proud of. So they are certainly hoping, and a lot of the politicians, the political parties are really saying, no, this isn't going to happen this time, because they really want to reassure not just the population, but investors, businesses, that they're not going to have this huge period of uncertainty afterwards. But the issue that really caused the problem last time was a swell in support for the separatist party, the NVA party. They got something like 17% of the vote. And this is a party that wants the northern province of Flanders, a Dutch-speaking province, to eventually have independence. So because this party got such a high share of the vote last time, all the smaller parties had to cobble together a coalition, a very complicated coalition. That's what took the time. But now fast forward until this year, and it's not like the separatist party has gone down in the polls. In fact, it's predicted to do even better, to get up to 32% of the vote. So this doesn't bode particularly well for the coalition horse trading we're going to see after the election.
Well, let's hope that Belgium doesn't break that world record this time again. That was Charlotte MacDonald-Gibson, Monocle's Brussels correspondent. Thank you as ever for joining us. Up next here on Midori House, we'll be asking whether the West's major art auction houses have got their strategy in mainland China all wrong. Do stay with us.
Creativity comes in all shapes and sizes at Salone del Mobile, the world's leading furniture fair in Milan, as companies and designers, new and old, compete for the attention of the world's leading buyers, interior designers, and media.
functional rather than flamboyant shapes. Design that is not about the designer, but the needs of the end user. And materials from Mother Nature all made headlines this year. It's a recipe many believe works for the long haul, and one brands and retailers were happy to toast to.
Pull up a chair and watch our film report on this year's Milan Furniture Fair, now playing on Monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Markus Hippi. It was an art sale that promised to reap rich rewards for yet another Western auctions house, increasingly asserting itself into the burgeoning Chinese art market. The Sotheby's sale in Shanghai on Saturday earned $20 million, with works by Picasso, Andy Warhol and Chinese artists among the top sellers. But the overall takings were lower than expected, and it is the Chinese works for sale that did best, which is a pattern that seems to be becoming increasingly common in the sale rooms of major international auction houses on Chinese soil. Well, joining me now is Alex Seno, a culture writer and arts commentator based in Hong Kong. Welcome to the program, Alex. Shall we start by talking about the Chinese taste? Why does it seem that art collectors in mainland China are more interested in Chinese art than works of modern masters?
Well, for the most part, if you're talking about buyers from China, it goes back a lot to their own taste and the art education from which they come from. And that's heavily, heavily focused on traditional Chinese art. So tradition, culture, context, history is very important. You know, if you're a Chinese collector or a buyer of art in China, and you look at Western art, in many ways that's still very foreign in terms of very much the other in terms of what, you know, what Western art represents.
To which extent is the Chinese appetite on Western art growing nowadays?
Well, I think there is an interest, but the core of connoisseurship in China is always going to be Chinese. With regards to the Christie's sale, I was at the preview for the first sale that they did last year. And although I think it looks a lot like this one relied a lot on local buyers, that first sale relied quite a bit on international buyers. In fact, I understand Christie's flew in a number of patrons from Europe for that sale. So if you're just looking at Christie's, I would look at it as something more than just selling to Chinese. Clearly, it has a lot to do with the optics of what having a sale like this looks like for an international auction house.
Do you think when you look at these bigger auction houses and also smaller ones that are still betting on China, do you think they need to do things differently? Are they getting their strategy wrong in mainland China?
Well, I think that for the most part, China will always be a market for Chinese auction houses. If you look at Guardian and Poly and the nine, you know, the 90 or 100 other auction houses that operate quite actively in the mainland, they're doing quite well. But the way they do things is, you know, very particular to the market for a lot of reasons, for tax reasons, for reasons of taste, for reasons of marketing. I think that there is a role for international auction houses in the mainland, but that role, for a long time, is going to be a minor role.
You sound quite determined that this is a situation that is not going to change. Basically, what you said there was that Chinese auction houses will always have a very important role in China, and the Chinese people are going to keep on buying Chinese art. Why are you so sure that this is not going to change?
Well, I think that in the future, there will be more buyers of Western art, but from China. But because of the context and the education on the mainland, the preference I think will always be for traditional antiquities and Chinese painting, which comes from a completely different tradition.
And considering that, do you think the Western auction houses should somehow change their strategy when they're dealing with mainland China?
Well, I think as an auction house, you offer two things. One is a platform where buyers can feel secure, but also a space for which people can offer inventory. I think that as far as getting good works, if you're looking for traditional work, sometimes it's possible for big houses like Christie's and Sotheby's to get better pieces with better provenance as far as traditional Chinese painting goes. But the thing is, the strength for many of these houses is in Western art, both contemporary and antiques.
And at the same time, Hong Kong's art landscape is significantly different. Do you think any lessons could be learned from there that could be transferred and used in mainland China?
I think that if you look at the Hong Kong auction scene, which is by some counts number 3 in the world, that business is primarily a Chinese business. So you have buyers from mainland China using Hong Kong as a marketplace to buy and sell primarily jewelry, Chinese antiques, and Chinese painting. That's still very dominant. Although many of the auction houses have started to introduce a Western program, that really hasn't caught in the same way that Chinese art and antiquities has. I think that for the moment, because the mainland market is closed and there are still very stringent customs and tax regulations, Hong Kong is unique in that way, and that it's hard to apply lessons learned doing business here to the mainland, which is very particular tax and customs regulations.
And before I let you go, to get back to mainland China, when you think of these Western auction houses trying to operate over there, do you think they would benefit more if they involved more with the local people and networked more with the local industries to get a better understanding of the Chinese market?
Absolutely. I think customer relations is very, very important, and that is one area that where Christie's and Sotheby's and Bonhams and other Western-based auction houses have really worked hard on. I think understanding how the market is changing, understanding how taste is changing is very important. And although the market for Western art is always going to be a sliver of what the market for Chinese art is going to be, as this tiny sliver of collectors who are interested in buying more Western art grows, that is also going to become very important as far as their own market share is concerned.
Thank you very much. That was Alexino, culture writer and arts commentator based in Hong Kong. You are with Midori House.
Should cities ban the car? Can we make truly sustainable metropolises? What happens if neighbourhoods lose their corner shops? How do you put a stop to suburban decay? Do children belong in big bad capitals? Can Detroit be saved? Can Sydney become a cycle capital? Can we learn to love concrete? And are rich cities always boring? If you want the answers to the big questions facing our cities, you need to tune in to The Urbanist, Monocle 24 Radio's weekly show about the cities we live in. Expect global reports, great interviews, passionate debate, and some surprises too, because drag star taxi drivers, love motel owners, and retail rebels also get their say. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 hours London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Marco Sippi. It is 2048 in Jerusalem, 1848 in London, and 1048 a.m. in San Francisco. Before we head to Istanbul to review some of the most recent art openings there, let's hear from Turkish pop singer Hande Yener. This is Ya Ya Ya Ya. From Turkey, that was Hande Yener with Ya Ya Ya Ya. You're listening to Monocle 24. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and it's time now to end the show to review the cultural landscape in one corner of the world. Today we head to Turkey, and Joseph Dane, a Monocle's correspondent in Istanbul, joins me now to discuss the city's most exciting art exhibitions. Joseph, welcome to the program. You want to talk about three exhibitions today. I'm wondering if there is a theme that these three exhibitions would share.
Well, there's a broad theme that they do share, and that's exactly what I think art should do, and especially in a country in which, you know, there's a kind of heightened political crisis, and that is discuss and unpack and help to understand what the real political issues of the day actually mean for the citizens and for the society. And so that's what I think the real general broad theme of these three exhibitions kind of tackles.
Well, the first exhibition you want to talk about today is quite an interesting one. It's got a clear connection with what we've been seeing happening in Turkey during the last months. This exhibition is called Disobedience Archive. What is going on over there?
So this is an exhibition that's hosted by Salt Beyoğlu, which is one of the more kind of recognized international galleries and also kind of academic art spaces in Istanbul. And they have a really lovely location right on İstiklal Boulevard, which is the main kind of pedestrian street that kind of funnels out of Taksim Square on the European side of Istanbul. And this is curated by two foreigners, and it looks at the kind of relationship between artistic practice and political action. And, you know, this is something that you come across a lot in the art world these days because of, you know, the Occupy movement, because of the Gezi Park movement, because of the Arab Spring. It's raising this kind of heightened attention to what exactly the relationship is between art and political action. The reason why I think that this one is specifically so good is exactly the location of the exhibition space itself, which right on this this kind of heavily pedestrianized street where often these protests do take place. In fact, the cops have actually accidentally thrown tear gas canisters into this exhibition space itself, which makes it all the more interesting. And I can say from my own perspective, and I've been and seen and reported on demonstrations in multiple countries after the Arab Spring in this region, it was very interesting to see some of the connections come out through some of the kind of video exhibitions that they had and some of the kind of print, you know, interesting kind of graphic design visuals about, you know, what different protesters wear in different countries and why they wear those certain things to protect themselves from tear gas, for example. And so I can only imagine that a tourist that's visiting Istanbul, that's in this really heavily touristic kind of space, will find this exhibition to be very interesting, to kind of pop in there and actually get a kind of local or almost behind the scenes feel as to what exactly is going on in terms of the protest space in the city itself.
How would you describe the way this exhibition deals with the Gezi Park movement and the recent unrest in Turkey?
Well, it's very interesting because it takes what I would say a very pragmatic, almost kind of urbanistic approach to looking at how political movements and political actions unfold, really starting in the 1970s in Italy, moving through some of the various Latin American protest movements that we've seen, and then ending with Gezi Park. And so we have this kind of broad thematic division, which they kind of separate some of the issues, you know, kind of in terms of the park, the street, the square, and they look at how this movement has broadly kind of materialized in Turkish society. And like I said, some of the kind of little things are what I found to be the most interesting in terms of, you know, why certain protesters are wearing certain types of gas masks and you know, the role that the supporter football club groups have had inside of Turkish society and inside of the Gezi Park movement. I mean, what you ultimately come away with is the fact that this is not a narrow group of people, that there are a broad cross-section of society that came out to the streets, and if you were on the streets at that time, and indeed if you're on the streets this week, you know, the May Day protest is coming up, you will see that broad cross-section of society. And because of the exhibition, you will kind of be able to understand it a little bit better.
Joseph, shall we talk about the second exhibition you have for us? What is it all about?
We should. This is an exhibition in a very lovely gallery in the Karaköy neighborhood of Istanbul, a gallery called Gallery Mana. And it's the exhibition is called Who shall deliver us from the Greeks and the Romans? And broadly, it looks at classical kind of Roman and Greek artistic, you know, kind of the foundations of Roman and Greek artistic legacy, and asked if we can differentiate between high and low art, and whether or not we can see in the past exactly where our art foundations are coming from. Now, what I found interesting in this exhibition specifically, aside from the fact that the art is very pretty, you know, we've got these classic kind of Roman marble, Roman busts and things like this. Aside from that, is that it's all essentially copies of these masterpieces. And this is happening down the street from another exhibition space that recently hosted a Miro retrospective. And it came to pass that something like 60 or 70% of the pictures that were in this Miro retrospective were in fact fake. And so we were looking at copies and not knowing that we were looking at copies. And in this specific gallery, they're you know, clearly stating that all of this is copies, but they're asking you to kind of reconceptualize what it means, you know, the difference between high and low art, and also, you know, the subtext of looking at classic Greek kind of artistic representation in a city like Istanbul has its own kind of political manifestations and layers, and that's always fun to see how the art world is able to negotiate these very, very delicate political spaces really quite deftly in this society.
That sure sounds good. Thank you very much. That was Joseph Dana, Monaco's Eastern Mediterranean correspondent with exhibitions this week. Thank you very much indeed. And that's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests Darren McCaffrey and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Today's show is produced by Thomas Lewis, researched by Alex Firmenich and Lillian Hess. Our studio manager was Joel Church. Next after the headlines is Culture with Robert Bound. Then at 2200 hours London time is the Monocle Daily with Dominic Reynolds and Guy Delaney. This show will be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House and from me, Markus Hippi, it is goodbye. Thank you for listening.
From London.
Tao Beijing.
This is Monaco 24.
Nach Amsterdam,
a Bogota,
to Hong Kong,
all around the world.
This is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.